are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 13th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, University of San Francisco law professor Peter John Hosenberg on A Place Outside the Law, Forgotten Voices from Guantanamo. Also on the program today, Pelosi to release articles of impeachment later this week. Says the House may subpoena Bolton. Meanwhile, a McConnell sandwich. He's stuck between his Kentucky voters and Pennsylvania swing voters who have diametrically opposed ideas of how McConnell should hold the trial in the Senate. Meanwhile, the Trump administration tries to justify its Soleimani assassination as protests continue in Iran over the Iranian government's downing of a commercial jet. And it's reported that Iran made sure U.S. troops knew the details of the Iranian missile attack in advance. There are some rational actors. Sanders takes a lead in Iowa as all the campaigns go on the attack, except for Cory Booker's, as he is out. Meanwhile, Joe Biden running hard from his Iraq war vote. AOC launches a PAC to support progressives, both incumbents and Democratic challengers. In New Hampshire, Sanders gets a key union endorsement. And lastly, the heartwarming story of Donald Trump icing Matt Gaetz over his War Powers Act speech. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the program. It is Monday. Michael's out, I think, for most of the week on a personal fact-finding mission. He's trying to find himself. But everybody else is here. We have quite a week for you ahead. Tomorrow night will be the last debate before the Iowa caucus. So this is it as we head into the debate. And, of course, we will get to all of the rigmarole over the weekend. Everybody's opening up their oppo drawers and their sort of late game strategies. It is, at least in the context of the Iowa caucuses, which really do tend to set the tone for the Democrats in particular. For whatever reason, the Democratic Party in particular, Iowa is a huge, huge, it's hard to say, causation, correlation, but it correlates, the winner of Iowa correlates very closely to the, at least in modern times, to the winner of the Democratic primary. Of course, who knows? We're living in a very strange era, people are putting the pedal to the metal, as it were. And we will get into that, of course. We'll also talk about impeachment. I mentioned the other day that Trey Gowdy had written an opinion piece that echoed what I'd been saying for months about impeachment. Not to pat myself on the shoulder, but it's these things are far and few between. So when they happen, I want to make sure that I have patted myself on the shoulder. But there's an interesting piece about Chuck Schumer, you know, in classic Schumer style, will take the least ambitious opportunity to maximize the value of impeachment to the hopes of a Democratic Senate in the fall. He will take the least risky, the least upside, the one that protects him the most. We live in a blue state, folks. The reason why you would want, theoretically, a senator from a deep blue state to be the Senate minority or majority leader is presumably because they have the freedom to function in a way that is actually going to be good for Democrats nationally. And we can see this constraint on Mitch McConnell, yet he still manages to do it. It has literally been like years of watching the Washington Wizards play the Globetrotters. But we will talk more about that later. In the meantime, the Trump administration is still in the position of attempting to justify their assassination of Qasem Soleimani. And it's stunning, frankly. This is a great opportunity for those of us who are trying to curb the institution of the presidency's power to wage war, to take advantage of this. There have been many opportunities like this. And sadly, not specifically in terms of War Powers Act, but across the board, whether it's protection for whistleblowers, whether it's any number of initiatives that could be taken to take advantage of the general disdain for Donald Trump, to use that as a lever in which to get reforms across that we couldn't get across during Obama because everybody trusted Obama, at least on the left, and at least in these issue silos. So it's, civil rights and whistleblower protections, et cetera. Hopefully we will get more in terms of War Powers Act resolutions, as it were. And I think Bernie and Senator Mike Lee are working on a joint resolution. And it's helpful to use people who are so incompetent. Now, the story that is being leaked now is that Donald Trump authorized this 6 months ago. And they just needed the right time. I say BS. There is an entire project to make this look like this was not Donald Trump sitting in his office thinking about how he could get the story off of impeachment. And these lunatics, Mike Pompeo and Mark Milley and Secretary of Raytheon, going in and seeing an opportunity and knowing that the Mad King might just be mad enough to start a war. Fortunately for us, the Iranians showed a certain amount of rationality. They made sure that our soldiers, as reported by CNN today, were aware, not specifically the soldiers, whatever, the leadership, of where they were going to be firing these missiles. And so these bases were essentially evacuated, at least the areas in which they were bombed. Here is Mike Pompeo trying to figure out how to answer this question of Donald Trump on Friday saying four embassies were going to be attacked. Mike Espers, is that his name, Mike or whatever it is? Mark Espers over the weekend saying, well, I didn't see any of that. But if he believed it, then I believe it. Like we're talking about Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. Like when there is an imminent attack on four of your embassies, that's a fairly specific claim. It's not just something, well, we take it on faith. He could have. Here's Mike Pompeo getting a little frustrated at the fact that he has to answer questions.
Secretary Pompeo, if I can, here today at the podium, you said that the imminent threat was a threat to U.S. embassies. You didn't know precisely when or where. Last night, the president said it was a threat to embassies, including to our Baghdad embassy. Why can you say that here, and the president could say it at a rally in Toledo, but no one said it to lawmakers behind closed doors in a classified setting, as multiple senators have since said?
We did.
You said, so the senators are lying when they say that...
We told them about the imminent threat, all of the intelligence that we've briefed, that you've heard today, I assure you, in an unclassified setting, we provide in the classified setting as well.
To be clear, you told them that embassies were to be targeted. That was the imminent threat.
I'm not going to talk about the details of what we shared in the classified setting, but make no mistake about it. Those leaders...
Pause
those
it. Let me just... Here's the big tell. First of all, if you're saying it publicly... Why can't you say that we said that it during the classified? Like, there's no new information here. It's just that when it really counted, like, you're not going to tell whether or not you told the senators when it really counted. And the big tell is, just go back a little bit. What does he say? Like, I want to be absolutely clear. What is there's the tell, you know, like when it's like, look, it's clear you know I'm lying. So I'm going to say something that is going to start that is really meaningless, but it's going to sound incredibly authoritative and definitive.
Well, he slips between the guy says, did you tell them or did you say that? And he says it was provided and they have access to that information. So that's where I think he's
right. It was provided publicly and they have access to that information. But we weren't going to say it to him directly because they'll know we're lying. And they'll call us on it. They'll say, show us the proof because we're allowed to see the proof.
We did.
You said, so the senators are lying when they say that...
We told them about the imminent threat, all of the intelligence that we've briefed, that you've heard today, I assure you, in an unclassified setting, we provide in the classified setting as well.
To be clear, you told them that embassies were to be targeted. That was the imminent threat.
I'm not going to talk about the details of what we shared in the classified setting, but make no mistake about it. Leaders, those members of Congress who want to go access this same intelligence can see that very same intelligence that will reflect what I described to you and what the president said last night.
Is that threat now gone with Soleimani gone?
Threats are never gone. Right? It's always a lot of danger in the world. Always a lot of danger in the world throughout the region. Nobody believed that a single mission in any respect took down the risk of terror. Terror from Al-Qaeda, terror from ISIS, terror from Al-Shabaab. No one believes that. The president doesn't. Look at the list, though. Look at the achievements in the administration.
Yeah.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
There it is. Mike Pompeo trying desperately to make it look like this wasn't just simply Donald Trump trying to divert attention from impeachment at the risk of a massive war. And, you know, one day, I don't know, maybe we will, maybe we won't. We will hear the story of Mike Pompeo and Mark Milley and Mark Espers figuring out, hey, we're all on the same page. We all think we should be doing this. And let's give it to an option to Donald Trump. And then it's just a question of we drop a bowling ball and let it roll down the hill. And fortunately, the Iranians were savvy enough to realize, like, oh, we can stop this ball from rolling. And it's not as if we couldn't have stopped it from rolling, but if Donald Trump's manhood was challenged enough and he saw numbers that said, oh, they've actually bombed us, I need to strike back now, then it's off to the races. So... Mike Pompeo, mission unaccomplished. We'll see if they get a second bite of this apple. But I don't know. I doubt it.
Do you think that the war's unpopularity played a role in Trump backing down on this as well? Because he seems completely driven by people liking him.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I think Trump was aware. Well, look, I think Trump was aware that a war would not be helpful to him. And
because Geraldo told him on Fox News.
Well, maybe Geraldo talked, but I think he can read polls And I think he thought he could look strong and it would be, you know, and I think he was told that. I think had the Iranians responded by, I don't know what it would, maybe, you know, I don't know if it would be blowing up our embassy or having some sleeper cell attack the U.S., the continental U.S., maybe the polling would change and his calculation would change. But I want to remind people, Ronald Reagan was able to stop that ball from rolling when he pulled out of Lebanon after 250 some odd soldiers were killed in a base in Lebanon. It's always doable, but he's a lunatic. He's surrounded by lunatics. Who knows? But I think, yes, in this instance, the failure to create a narrative leading up to this moment is helped all of us. And I think the fact that, look, there's a certain amount of war weariness that I think the U.S. public has. But you can't go out there and say, we killed the number one terrorist that you never heard about. I mean, it just doesn't work.
He wasn't even on the playing cards.
He wasn't on the playing cards. There was no, he wasn't part of the axis of the Troika of Evil or whatever, you know, the construction they were going to have. Yeah, it just didn't work. Folks, we're still in January. We're still only a couple weeks away. Saul was asking me over the weekend. He's like, I just said Happy New Year to that guy. We were out in the park, of course, because it was a beautiful January day in New York, 69 degrees, 70 degrees, and typical. And we were out watching people fly kites, and Saul also heard somebody say, Happy New Year. And he's like, Happy New Year was a long time ago. I'm like, well, actually, it was only like 2 weeks ago. That seems like a lot to you, but it's still at the beginning of the year. The point being, now some of you made some resolutions. What were they? Manage your personal finances, take better care of yourself. Jamie? Harry's Razors will help you achieve both of those things because razors can be expensive, but Harry's costs $2 per cartridge. Harry's makes award-winning razors along with a whole range of grooming essentials to keep your 2020 routine in top shape. Look, Harry's understands that a great shave does not come from, these Rambo blades with the flex balls or the heated handles. Harry's is a return to the essentials. Quality craftsmanship at a fair price. They source their steel from Sweden and manufacture their blades in a world-class factory in Germany. Harry's cut out the middleman and ship directly to you, saving money and time. If you don't love your shave, you let them know. They'll give you a full refund, 100% quality guarantee. For me, my faves, the narrow blade head and the sort of the stylish classical looking handles, frankly. I got mine in chrome. I like the shaving lotion too, but for me, it's the narrowness of the blade, and I get a great shave. I don't like to shave that often, but when I do, Harry's has a special offer for listeners of my show. New customers get $5 off the trial set. Go to harrys.com/majority report. You're going to get a 5-blade razor. Comes with that weighted handle that I mentioned. You get the foaming shave gel with aloe and a travel cover. Join the millions of guys who have already switched and go to Harry's, HARRYS.com/majority report to claim your offer. So I shave, folks, on occasion, but I have yet to have a consistent period in my life where I wear bras. But I can tell you this, that Third Love's bra styles are designed with measurements from millions of women. They are designed to fit your life. They have over 80 bra sizes, and they know that the only one that matters is yours. Like I say, I am not a bra wearer, but we had the in-house majority report bra tester try it out. This is what she had to say. I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two, both fit. That almost never, ever happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. I'm really coming to understand the term basic. I didn't know it before.
Just in time for it to be driven into the ground.
Exactly. This is the hands down most comfortable bra you'll ever own, with straps that don't slip, tagless labels, lightweight, memory foam cups mold to your shape. Plus, returns and exchanges are free and easy. In fact, thanks to Third Love's perfect fit promise, every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, and put it to the test. And if you don't love it, all you got to do is return it. And Third Love is going to wash it, and then they will donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority right now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. Folks, go there. Buy your bras, get 15% off, buy a bunch of them. They don't work out, you return them. That's the way I roll when I get that first time offer discount. I'm just, you know. There you go. Folks, this is the season where you want to hibernate, except for, of course, this past weekend, where you want to get out because it was 69 degrees in New York City. It was insane.
It was ominously nice out.
It was very disturbing. But then, you know, you get a day today, it's 40s, 30s. You want to go back inside. You want to snuggle up on your couch or your chair. That's where Joybird comes in. They have over 50 fabric and leather options. They got three shades of wood. They have 250 different unique forms or silhouettes. You do the math, ladies and gentlemen. Joybird has a lot to choose from. That means that you can basically design the piece of furniture that suits you and your tastes. You can bring your mood boards to life. You can, you know, if you want, I don't know, bubblegum pink on your couch, you can do it. I don't know why you would do that. Maybe some people, I guess. But it's built by Joybird, designed by you. They offer a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery, which I wish this existed, or at least I was aware of it 10 years ago. They have free fabric swatch kits, which you can feel the fabric, check out what you like, help you make the best choice. And they have free personal design consultants at Joybird who can help you go from your ideas to it sitting in your living room or your den or your bedroom, wherever. They have a 365-day home trial. So you basically are living in their showroom, or their showroom lives in your home. You even get free returns within 2 weeks of delivery. Create furniture that matches your own fearless style at joybird.com/majority25. You can see how Joybird can make your dream space a reality today at joybird.com/majority25. Go to joybird.com/majority25 and receive an exclusive offer, 25% off your first order, by using the code majority25. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I will be talking to Professor Peter Jan Honigsberg on his oral history of Guantanamo Bay, a place outside the law, forgotten voices from Guantanamo. Disturbing stuff, but very important for us to keep in mind. Quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Got a wise boy to come with somewhere.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Law at the University of San Francisco, author of A Place Outside the Law, Forgotten Voices from Guantanamo, Professor Peter Jan Honigsberg, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Sam. Thank you. And let me be another person to wish you Happy New Year.
Oh, well, thank you. And Happy New Year's to you as well.
Thank you.
We are now, I guess, 2 days out from what was, if I'm not mistaken, the 17th anniversary of, I guess, the formal opening of the detention center in Guantanamo Bay.
Actually, the 18th. It was 18th. In 2002.
Okay. So that was basically 4 months after, not even 4 months, just a couple months after we...
4 months after 9/11, September 11th to January 11th.
All right. And at its peak... And I'll get into the details, but I just want to put just some of the numbers down first. At its peak, there were 780 people, or
that's correct. Okay. Over the almost two decades, there were 780 people,
and there are 40 to as far as I know.
That's correct.
Remaining
40 people remain.
Six of whom who will be tried, and then the other 34 are basically in prison for life without ever being tried.
Well, actually, two there are convicted. One was sentenced. The other is waiting to be sentenced. So there are two others there. But there are 26 people who are called forever prisoners. There's not enough evidence to try them and convict them, because the evidence they obtained on these men were through torture. But the government somehow feels that these men are dangerous and they can't release them. So basically, they're there without charges and they'll never be prosecuted, no convictions, and they'll probably die there never having been charged, which is unheard of. No country in the world has ever held people for that long without charges. Then there are five other men there who were actually... could have been released by President Obama, but for various reasons weren't released in time. And they're there now, and Trump, of course, won't release them. So maybe if they were a Democratic president, he or she might release them. But at this point, they're there as well.
Okay. Will you just outline, I want to, before we talk about how people got to Guantanamo, will you just outline for us, like, you know, why Guantanamo was chosen? This is about a 40 square mile patch of land in Cuba. It is not Cuban per se. It is basically our little outpost in Cuba. Will you just explain that to people? Because I don't think that people are fully aware of this dynamic, and then talk about why it was chosen, which is in part a function of it being such an odd piece of land.
Actually, at the turn of the last century, the U.S. took control of that 40-mile stretch from Cuba, and they contracted with Cuba where they would pay Cuba $2,000 a year in gold for the lease. And then they Cuba tried to get out of the lease, but the lease said that either country can maintain the lease. Both countries have to agree to cancel it. And of course, the U.S. won't. And Cuba won't accept the money anymore, but the U.S. keeps paying them. And the U.S. just keeps the land. And Cuba, of course, cannot go in and attack the U.S. to take it back. So the U.S. just controls that land, and they have for more than a century. And after 9/11, the government was looking for a place where they could house the captives, and they wanted a place that, as the reason why my book is called A Place Outside the Law, they wanted a place that was, quote, outside the law, where they felt the federal courts could never intervene in that. They could do whatever they wanted to these men, and no one would be able to stop that. And so they actually looked at places all over the world, including putting men on ships. And there were just too many men to put on ships, and putting them into other bases around the world. But they decided that there were a lot of advantages in going to Guantanamo, one of which was close to the U.S. mainland, so that officials and military officials could fly down there when necessary. And also because they believed, since it was, quote, on Cuban soil, And there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision from the 1940s that seemed to indicate that these men might not have any recourse and not have the right to go to federal court to challenge their detentions. That was wrong, but at that point, that's what the federal government officials thought, and that's why they chose Guantanamo.
Because there was this sense that the U.S. government had that this is neither fish nor fowl. We're in basically, I guess, international waters, as it were, even though that we're essentially we claim authority over it. Nobody, you know, if you're on a boat in international I don't even understand how the legal logic could have worked. I mean, it's under U.S. control. But when did the Supreme Court ultimately decide that, yeah, that theory, sorry, that's not going to work?
Well, actually, they first decided in 2004. And I can tell you a cute story behind that. And the U.S. government kind of challenged it. Supreme Court said that the detainees had the right to challenge their detentions in federal court under what they call statutory habeas. And the federal government said, we're going to change the law there and consequently still keep the men from challenging their detentions. And so the lawyers on behalf of the detainees went back to court. And then in 2008, they came up with a constitutional decision which said that the men had an absolute right under the U.S. Constitution to challenge their detentions in court. And that was pretty remarkable. The government never should have let them get to the Constitution because that has changed the law and can't be returned. So that's what happened. But initially, there was a 2004, a very early decision, given that the war began in 2001, for the Supreme Court to step in a war and decide that the men had the right to challenge their detentions. But they did. And I'll tell you this cute story, Sam. One of the and no one expects the Supreme Court to take the case. And one of the lawyers who appealed to the Supreme Court to take the case, a man named Tom Wilner, lives in Washington, D.C., wrote in his brief to the court asking them to take the case that when the Cuban iguana is in Cuba, it is a delicacy and can be eaten. But if the Cuban iguana happens to crawl under the fence and come into Guantanamo Naval Base, it is protected by the Endangered Species Act. And so Wilner argued that the Cuban iguana had more rights than the men in Guantanamo. And of course, the Supreme Court never touched that on paper, but we often wonder whether that had some impact on them.
Oh, that's fascinating. And what were... What was the and I want to get to, you know, some of the people you talked to and sort of like the basis of the book in just a moment. But what were the implications for the prisoners in Guantanamo of that legal decision? Like, how did their destinies or their fates in that more or their trajectories change because of those legal rulings?
Well, unfortunately, after the first legal ruling, not much changed, except that they had now a right to a lawyer. Before then, lawyers were not allowed to go down to the base to represent them. And so they were completely at the mercy of the U.S. government. Once that decision came out, it entitled them to an attorney. At least once attorneys came down there, they had a little bit more protection in a sense. The attorneys could observe what was going on. And so a lot of the torture, much of which was psychological, seemed to become much more limited after that first 2004 decision. But because the U.S. government did a lot of machinations, which are too complicated for me to go with you over the phone, there wasn't a whole lot of success on challenging detentions. Subsequently, from 2004, it wasn't it wasn't until 2008 with a later constitutional decision that it made a difference. I will tell you a couple of things along those lines, Sam, since you asked. A lot of lawyers believe, and it seems to be true, that essentially lawyers didn't help the detainees as much as they would have liked to, that in fact people who were released from Guantanamo were pretty much released because the administration decided it was time to release them. The courts tended to go with the government, and so if the government challenged any of the claims of the detainees that they should be released, usually the courts afraid to, quote, release a terrorist tended to side with the U.S. government. And the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals is very conservative. sided with the U.S. government on every decision. Consequently, these men were not re-released by the courts. They were released because the U.S. government decided it was time to release them. And there were lots of political reasons why they released them when they did. Sometimes they released them because they were members of a country or citizens of a country that President Bush wanted to have join his allegiance against Iraq, and he just wanted them to be on their side, so he'd release them as a favor to the country. So a lot of it was political, and unfortunately, the lawyers got very frustrated because they did a phenomenal job. They worked really hard. They were very passionate. But at the end of the day, the courts tended to side with the U.S. government for fear that, quote, they would be releasing a terrorist, and they didn't want that on their hands. I will add something else, Sam, just so people have a context. The 780 people in Guantanamo, a large number of them, can't say, but it's likely a majority even, were purchased by the U.S. government. They weren't, quote, captured. What happened was the U.S. government dropped flyers over Afghanistan after 9/11, and the flyers said that if you bring us Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters, we'll pay you. And they paid $3,000 to $5,000 a person. So essentially, anybody who was a stranger or even a tribal enemy was worth a lot of money to anybody on the ground who could grab them. And so we purchased everybody who they brought to us. And so a lot of the people in Guantanamo were just people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And people made a lot of money selling them to us.
Do we know how many of those people exist? And I should say, like, was there any vetting process? So, I'm at a military command in Kabul, or I'm at Bagram Air Base, and people show up at the front gate. Here, we've got this guy. We tied him up. He's Al-Qaeda. Okay, here's your $3,000. Was there any vetting process? And then what happened to a lot of those people? Because a lot of this torture began in Afghanistan.
That's correct. Most of the physical torture that the Guantanamo detainees suffered was most severe in Afghanistan, and there was not a whole lot of vetting. They pretty much thought that whoever they had could be a potential terrorist. There was a terrorist. They didn't really vet them all that much. Most of them were just put in these big tents and held there, tied up and tortured, and then ultimately put on a plane and sent to Guantanamo. If they actually captured someone who was a threat, they sent them to what they call a black site, a CIA-run black site around the world, about 125. There was no official number, but approximately that number of people were sent to places around the world and severely tortured by the CIA or by proxies of the CIA. But the rest of the people were either in Afghanistan and then pretty much sent to Guantanamo. They figured they'd vet them in Guantanamo, which was not really all that happened. It's like I said, a lot of it was politics.
All right. And so your book is essentially an oral history. You have been working on this for at least a decade at this point.
Correct.
What was the impetus for this book?
That's a great question. What happened was back in 2008, when President Obama, or that time candidate Barack Obama, was running and John McCain was running for the Republican Party, both men said that they want to close Guantanamo. And actually, President George Bush also said he thought Guantanamo should be closed. So it seemed like in the air it was going to happen. And my concern, I had done, ever since 9/11, I had done work on terrorism post 9/11, and it seemed to me that, yes, they were probably going to, whoever became president was probably going to close it. And I was concerned that these stories of Guantanamo would fade away into the dustbin of history, if you will, and there was no narrative of Guantanamo. There's very little written about Guantanamo by that time, and no one had really told full-length stories and oral histories about Guantanamo, and once that closed, it'd be over, I felt. And so I was, excuse me, as long as you asked, I was actually inspired by my father. You probably know of the Shoah Foundation, which Steven Spielberg started in the 1980s. he wanted to document the Holocaust, and there were Holocaust deniers at that time. And my father had not been in a concentration camp, but had barely escaped from Austria just in time. And he was one of the people interviewed by the Shaw Foundation. I happened to be present when they interviewed him on camera film, and that inspired me. And I thought we should do that too. We should film these all histories of people, both the detainees who were there and Americans who were there as prison guards, interrogators, interpreters, military official, government officials, people who saw it from both sides. And so I was very fortunate. There was someone who had a small foundation in San Francisco, who Bay Area, who offered me some money to be able to go to five countries in the summer of 2009, interview 16 detainees. And that got the project started. And eventually we interviewed 158 people, both detainees and others, over that decade, telling their stories on film. And no one else has done that in the world, of course. And we have over 300 hours of film that we donated to Duke University Human Rights Archive, and they're going to ultimately put most of it up on the internet.
Did you, at the time when you started, did you anticipate that 10 years later, that Guantanamo would still be open, that there would still be more than two dozen prisoners, some of whom will die there?
Actually, it's funny you ask that. Even though I thought at first, well, maybe these men will close Guantanamo, I also don't trust what I hear, even from people who have good intentions. And I just felt that I don't know. I don't know if that will happen. And someone even from the Obama administration, when he won, from the transition team, called me up and said, look, Peter, look, we're going to close Guantanamo, and we're going to hold hearings, and you don't have to do this. And I said, well, I would love to know that's true, but I'm going to start this just in case that's not true. And so I was still doing it 10 years later. And so it's not that I'm cynical, even skeptical, but I just know the way politics works. And a good example of that, Sam, is, a lot of people, when we told people what we're doing, a lot of people said, well, Guantanamo's closed. I said, it's not closed. Why do you think that? And it's because President Obama said four times he was closing Guantanamo, and people believed if he said it, he did it. But he never did. And honestly, I'm not sure we want to go into, but it wasn't just the Republicans blocking him, that reason why he never did. But beside that, he never did. And so even people with very good intentions don't always follow through. And I just felt we had to do this for history.
I do actually want to get into that. But let's first talk a little bit about some of the people that you spoke to. Yes. And the thing that I was struck by was I have talked to advocates of abolishing the capital punishment. And one of the things that they talk about is, you never hear the stories of and obviously they shouldn't be centered, right? I mean, the victims are, but you never hear the stories of how the people who actually kill people, how it impacts
the
them,
like,
the executioners. Yeah. And there's a quality of your work here that I think sort of like brings that out as well. But let's start. I don't know if there is a detainee that sticks out in your mind that is most relevant. I'm curious about hearing about, and I may be pronouncing his name wrong, Murad Benchalali.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was French, and he was kind of naive. His brother actually had some connections to a terrorist organization and went to Afghanistan, and he encouraged Murad to follow him. Murad was a young man, and in fact, Sam, there were some number of, quote, juveniles in Guantanamo who were over 16. There were a few under 16 but most were between 16 and 18, and they were held there as adults. And Murad was, I think, 18 or 19, but he was naive, and he kind of followed his brother to Afghanistan and then was caught up like so many other strangers in Afghanistan and purchased and brought to Guantanamo. And he was miserable. One of the reasons why he caught my eye is because he was very depressed when we interviewed him the first time. We interviewed him a second time as well. And it was because he felt that what he saw at Guantanamo was much worse for him than a physical prison. It was a psychological prison. And I don't think people realize that. A lot of the torture and the physical beatings were done in Afghanistan, but when the men came to Guantanamo, they were more psychologically tortured. And to Murad and to most of the people we interviewed, detainees, that was worse. As one other French detainee said to us, once you pull out the knife, you start to heal, but with psychological torture, you never heal. And the UN rapporteur, special rapporteur for torture, told us that after 15 days in isolation, people usually never come back fully. And so these men were held in isolation sometimes for more than a year. And there were also other ways that they messed with these men in ways that Murad expressed you just couldn't come back from it. There was something called frequent flyer, where they took these men and moved them to a cell and let them stay there for 2 to 3 hours and came to them and said, time to move, and moved them again to another cell for 2 or 3 hours and then came back and said, time to move again. They did that for 2 or 3 weeks, and the men never got any sleep, and they just were moved from cell to cell. And that was called frequent flying. That was done as well. I can go into other ways of the psychological torture.
Please do.
They were told that they were going to go home, and they were dressed in street clothes, so they were going to put on a plane and go home. And then they were kept in another camp where they were told again and again they were going to go home, and then they never were going to go home. And then some days later or weeks later, they were taken and back to their cells and said, I guess you're not going home. And then another man was told once that his mother was on his way to Guantanamo and she was going to be raped and gang raped if he didn't start talking. And so it was in terms of how they mistreated these people. They took away what they called comfort items, where if you didn't behave, you didn't tell them what they want to hear, you were even denied toothbrushes or toilet paper, if you will, whatever it took to get them to be just more miserable and to feel defeated and to feel like there was no way out. In fact, some people said there was no way out. The rules in the prison also changed day to day. The people who were in charge just made up rules as the day went on. And so the men never knew what to expect from moment to moment. And they were also played with in another way. One Uyghur detainee, you know about the Uyghurs now, they're the Muslims in China. One Uyghur told us that that they came to pick up his meal and they asked for a spoon. And he said, you never gave me a spoon today. And they said, yes, we did. And he said, no, you didn't. So they brought in what they call the IRF force, which is a force of 6 guards that come in and mace the detainee and then beat him up and then carry him out and bring him to isolation. He said they did that. They probably knew he didn't have a spoon, but they did that just to throw him off guard. They kind of want people not to be resisted, not to fight back. And so you never knew if you're going to be irked or not. And this was another, even though it might be physical and sound physical to people, it was really more psychological because you never knew when you'd be irked. It would just happen for reasons that were not rational.
Now, I know that you spoke to a whistleblower and that there was some military guards you spoke to. But was there anybody who you spoke to who, or have you learned subsequent through other means that how systemic this was? I mean, how when they start this like frequent flyer program, as they called it, or when they would put someone in isolation for that extended period of time, or do any of these things, were these people, were the guards, was the commanders whoever authorized this? I mean, how high up the chain did it go in terms of authorization, A? And B, how studied was this? Or was this just sort of like something I learned when I was working at a jail, you know, a private prison in Pennsylvania or something like that? I mean, where did these ideas come from?
Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting question because it had to come from above. I mean, prison guards are not going to take that kind of initiative on their own. Someone had to tell them to do that. And the question is how high up from above, you know, whether Donald Rumsfeld did know about some of the tortures that were done in Guantanamo, whether he instructed these particular methods or whether people right below him did. Honestly, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I do think it was very diffuse, and I do think it was very clear that people had the option to do what they needed to do to get intel. What they were afraid of, what the government is very afraid of, is another 9/11 happening on their watch. And they wanted to get, and they weren't that concerned about these men other than if they had intel, they wanted it. And so on some level, the government officials, military officials, didn't really care what was done as long as they got the intel that would tell them if there was going to be another attack or not. So they pretty much let the interrogators off on their own. They let the prison guards on some level off on their own, basically in the hope that a detainee would, quote, break, although detainees didn't have much information, of course, because they weren't important. But their thinking was maybe they had something and they would break and tell it and we would stop another 9/11.
Has there ever been a public claim by the United States that there's been information obtained from any of those Guantanamo detainees that has prevented a terrorist attack in this country?
I think President Bush said something like 600 attacks were prevented thanks to the intel that he obtained, or the government obtained through various sources, probably through black sites as well as through Guantanamo, but it was never documented and no one ever believes that. I mean, if that was true, it certainly was. I haven't seen any documentation to say that.
Have you seen any documentation for one? I mean, I ask because, you know, just this week, Donald Trump is up there saying that they're, four embassies were about to be attacked imminent. You know, there was an imminent attack on four embassies. And, you know, the media is being skeptical of this. But,
well, Esper said that wasn't true. So,
well, Esper said that he didn't have the information, but he believes it if the Trump believes it. And but my point being that, you know, I was doing what I'm doing now during this era, and the credulity that was given George W. Bush in making these claims, and that Bush administration making these claims, is stunning. When, you know, the idea that we are now 10 years out from when he made that claim, more probably 12 years out when he made that claim, and there has not been one single iota shred of evidence to back that up, I think is pretty amazing. And I mean, that's why I say it, like the credulity that existed amongst the press, and just sort of like a largely, you know, he could say 600, you know, cases, you know, that we've stopped 600 terrorist attacks and that's the end of it. Everybody just sort of says, okay, it's stunning. Tell us about Matt Diaz.
I will say I'm not sure I can't document this because read it long ago, but I think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was going to take some planes and possibly do some more explosions on planes. And I'm not exactly sure how that works. And I don't remember the timeline on that. There was something about that that might or might not be true, but that's one of the only theories that I heard, and I'd have to look that up after we hang up, and you could look that up too.
But all right, fair enough. And so let's talk about Matt Diaz. He saw what was going wrong there very early. Who was he?
He was a lawyer who worked for the government right in Guantanamo, and his job was essentially to kind of cover for the Pentagon in Guantanamo. And one day he received a he was copied on a letter that a human rights lawyer in New York City at the Center for Constitutional Rights sent to the Pentagon asking for the names of the detainees. And Diaz was copied on it. And the Pentagon said, sorry, it's classified. We can't reveal the names. And this really upset Matt because he felt that a lot of the loved ones of the detainees thought the detainees were dead. What happened was when we bombed Afghanistan, a lot of the men escaped to Pakistan or tried to escape to Pakistan and were captured. But some of them died in the bombings, of course, and a lot of families thought that their loved ones had died. And so they didn't even know their loved ones were alive, and yet their loved ones were alive in Guantanamo. And so Matt felt that if the U.S. government was never going to release the names, which is, by the way, it violates the Geneva Conventions, then these families would never know that their loved ones were there. And so Matt felt if the Pentagon wasn't doing it, maybe he should. And he knew that was a violation of law. He knew that if he was caught, he could easily go to prison. But I think he felt he needed to do the right thing. As he said to us, he was on the wrong side of things. And I think he felt that that these families would never know that their loved ones were in Guantanamo. And he felt they needed to know that. Which adds something I mentioned, the Geneva Conventions. President Bush said in February of 2002 that Geneva Conventions do not apply to Guantanamo. The Supreme Court in 2006 said, actually, they do. But in the meantime, they didn't apply when Matt Diaz did this, where he decided he was going to download the names of the detainees in Guantanamo, cut it up into small names, sheets of paper, and then put them into a greeting card and send that greeting card to a lawyer in New York. And the next morning, Matt left the base. But a year later, he got caught.
And was tried.
He served 6 months. He could have gotten 24 years, but apparently the military jury seemed to understand where he was coming from, and he only got 6 months in prison. He lost his license to practice law in Kansas, but actually last year in 2019 he got his license to practice law in New York City, and now he's in New York. A defense lawyer, so you know, he's back on his feet, and it took him a long time to get there.
Can you talk about the development of the term enemy combatant? This was one of the fun things of that first decade of the aughts. This sort of new this new category of people, essentially.
Sam, I really appreciate you. You must have read the book or you read a large part of it. I'm very impressed. Thank you, because obviously you're asking me really intelligent questions and I appreciate it. Enemy combatant, from day one when I heard that term, I said, that's not a real term. That's a bogus term. There's no such thing. Under the Geneva Conventions, you're either a lawful combatant or an unlawful combatant, say like a spy. But that is the universe of combatants. And there's no such thing as enemy combatant. That's just a generic term and it means nothing. And yet the government kept using it. And they used that because they wanted to circumvent the Geneva Conventions, because they didn't want to get caught this, as Bush said, the Geneva Conventions don't apply. So it drove me nuts, to tell you the truth, because I knew somebody had come up with that term and it's not true. And I wanted to know who it was. And no matter how much research I did, I couldn't find it. And so when I started interviewing people in this project, I asked every military person I interviewed, I said, do you know where that term comes from? I didn't expect an answer, but I just thought I need to find out, because for history, we need to know that it was fake. And finally, just by chance, a very, very smart man who worked for the Pentagon, who was very highly respected.
Oh, hello?
Hello?
I'm sorry. We lost you. You dropped out for a moment. Who is highly respected?
Very highly respected military official in the Pentagon named Bill Litzau. He's a Marine, but he worked in the Pentagon. He worked for both Obama and Bush. He was very bright, very wonderful person in that field. We interviewed him. He agreed to interview with us, and I asked him that question too. And he said, matter of fact, I came up with the term. And he told us how it happened. He said that he was prepping some U.S. officials for a TV newscast, and they said, we need a term, and we can't use unlawful combatant because that has connotations of the Geneva Convention. So they said to Bill Litzau, can you come up with another term? And he said, well, you could use enemy combatant if you want, but it doesn't really mean anything. And they said, okay, we're going to use it. And the administration grabbed it and ran with it, and that's how it got life and legs.
And
from then on, they used it in every possible way.
And is that term now, is that recognized by the courts? In other words, when they try to make the case that, like, look, this guy's an enemy combatant, therefore none of the laws that we have apply because no one's ever referred to an enemy combatant before, because of course they've just made that up. I mean, that category is, you know, was minted specifically because it stood outside of the definitions that existed. Do courts recognize that as a legal classification now? I mean, because I remember they even said that about, like, Jose Padilla at the time.
They said that about Jose.
And this is a guy who's in Chicago. So
an American citizen.
Yeah. I mean, does any courts recognize that? I mean, if you were a lawyer from, the federal government, you came in and you said, so-and-so is an enemy combatant, would the judge say, I don't know what you're talking about there?
Well, I would hope that if a government lawyer said that, there'd be a lawyer representing the person who's being accused of being an enemy combatant and explain to the court that, in fact, that term has no meaning, that under the conventions which do apply to U.S., we sign the conventions, as every other country in the world has. That is not a term. And, in fact, Obama did acknowledge that, in fact, enemy combatant was not a term and tried to go back to the Geneva Conventions when he was president. But, you know, just the other day, Sam, I heard somebody use that term again. It might have been for the Iranian general who was killed. And so, it seems like it's on everyone's mind still, but it's not a term. And I think if anybody does go to the court with that term, I'm hoping that the lawyer for the other side would say, in fact, it's not. It has no meaning.
There's a lot more I want to talk to you about as specific individuals. You know, lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Back in the day, I used to interview Michael Ratner quite a bit. There are others. There was one person who was... literally, his nickname was King of the Torturers, who managed to be found not guilty when he was brought up in the court. But folks should check out your book. But before you go, I do want you to address the Obama administration's attempt to close Guantanamo and how much of that was a function. The argument that we heard from the Obama administration was that Congress basically stood in the way, that there was a fear-mongering sort of, like, I guess, initiative, if you will, to try people in New York, that if we hold people in, New York federal prison, then New York becomes a target again. If I'm not mistaken, Chuck Schumer, and you can correct me on this, came out and said, we can't have that here, that type of thing. But there was a lot of that. But you tell me the story as you know it.
Well, that's a separate story, Sam. I mean, it's true that there was a lot of pushback when Obama tried to bring some of the prosecutions in New York. But in fact, the prosecutions, you know, very, 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 very few people were prosecuted out of 780 people. Right. So those few prosecutions really have no bearing on closing the prison. They only have bearing on a few prosecutions. The actual closing of the prison is a different issue. And Obama said four different times during his 8 years in office that he wanted to close Guantanamo. And he claimed that the Republicans wouldn't let him. And that's because in each military appropriations bill, there was a clause that said that Guantanamo could not be closed. However, no one says, or very few people say, that Obama signed that bill every year. And he didn't have to sign it. Now, of course, he had to sign a bill to give funding to the military and the Pentagon. But he could easily have gone to Mitch McConnell and said, look, I'm not signing the bill until you take that provision out. And Obama didn't do that. He didn't go down and negotiate and deal with that for various reasons, which I can't tell you because I don't know. He didn't do it. And it happened year after year after year. He signed the bill that allowed the Republicans to forbid him from closing Guantanamo. So when he said that he wanted to close Guantanamo, I think he really did. I think he really did. But he also did not follow through where he could have.
Part of it was that they could not figure out a way to deal with the prisoners, right? I mean, like that the idea of housing them stateside and putting them was too onerous, I guess, in terms of like finding a suitable prison, and returning folks to their homes, to their home countries, was also off the table. Yes or no?
Well, you know, he didn't have to go there, because if he was forbidden from closing it, he didn't have to worry about what you just described. I mean, you know, if in fact he had the option to close it where he wasn't restricted by the Congress, he could have then thought on what to do with these men. I mean, as we said, most of them were released anyways, only 40 left. So in fact, they weren't all that much of a threat. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been released. And Obama released a number, about 200 men as well. So the fact is, no, he, you know, at some point he could have dealt with these last 40. The rest were out anyway. So he just, but he didn't give himself the option. By signing that bill every year, he didn't give himself the option to take the steps needed to close it. And he understood, and he even said it, Guantanamo was a stain on America. It was, you know, a stain on America. People, you know, I will tell you this, Sam, and, you know, some of the detainees we interviewed said to us that before they were brought to Guantanamo, they loved the U.S. They thought the U.S. was the standard, the golden standard for human rights and the rule of law. They really believe that. And then they see the way we treated them. And Obama understood that. He totally understood that. And he could have said, I'm closing it down and figure out a way to deal with the last 40 people. It wasn't that hard. If they got rid of 740 people, there were only 40 left. But he never gave himself the option when he signed that bill every year. That's my feeling.
Well, the book is A Place Outside the Law, Forgotten Voices from Guantanamo. It is it's a disturbing read, to be honest with you. But it's hugely important, and people need to have a better awareness of what we have been doing for 20 years. To folks, I have one more question, if you'll indulge me. What do you think that Guantanamo has done to has it had an impact on our national psyche in some way? I mean, has the when we talk about, you know, Martin Luther King said, you know, when a bomb goes off in Vietnam and explodes in cities here in the United States, has what we've been doing in Guantanamo, whether it is how it's impacted our court system, or whether or how it's impacted just our vocabulary, the idea of enemy combatant, this fake this sort of like extra judicial or extra legal status, has it impacted what we are willing to accept in this country?
You know, Sam, I'm not blowing smoke. I have to say, I really appreciate this conversation. You ask very intelligent question. I really appreciate it. I don't always get that. I really do. But in answering it, I got to tell you two parts to it. The first part is that whenever we went overseas, everyone knew about Guantanamo. Everyone cared about Guantanamo. Everyone would ask us about Guantanamo. It really mattered to people in other countries all the time. It was shocking, because then I came back to America. Like I said, I would tell people in America, they thought it was closed. They didn't want to think about it. They didn't want to hear about it. Essentially, it was such a stain on our national pride, people didn't want to know about it. It just was too painful. And, you know, and it's funny, you said my book is very disturbing. People always tell me that they're so glad I wrote the book. It's so important for history, but it's really, you know, so sad. And one woman said to me, she gets so sad and so mad when she read it, because it's against our nature. You know, we really believe in doing the right thing. I mean, we really care about doing the right thing. We do the right thing. And this is one of the darkest periods in American history where we didn't do the right thing. And people like to deny that, or at least not acknowledge it. They don't want to go there. It's just not what they want to see. They'd rather think it didn't happen, right? So these things are very disturbing, like you said, and therefore they'd rather think it was closed. They'd rather not address it. And unfortunately, until we do, we can't move on. I mean, really, I mean, some people think, you know, that was just a start of what allowed Trump to get away with what he's doing. Essentially, you know, we have to acknowledge when we do the wrong thing and come back to correcting it. We did that, took us 60 years with putting the Japanese Americans, many of whom were citizens, in internment camps. And we need to acknowledge it with Guantanamo, too. And I think when we do, we'll be a better country and a more unified country, and the country that we were, where we all believed in human rights and rule of law. No matter what side we were on, we all had the same values. And I think we need to go back there.
Peter Jan Hogensberg, the book is A Place Outside the Law, Forgotten Voices from Guantanamo. We'll put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Sam. It was an honor, a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks. Not sure that was the best thing to do on a Monday, but really disturbing. And I haven't been on this bandwagon for a while, but the inability of our media and our political system to deal with the lies of Donald Trump were. And maybe I'm limited by what, you know, the scope of my political awareness, at least temporally. But whether it was George Bush going up there and saying that we have thwarted 600 terrorist attacks from what we've learned by essentially torturing people at Guantanamo.
It's like almost an attack per detainee.
Yes. And or frankly, whether it was, you know, some Republican, you know, Arthur Laffer saying that when we cut taxes, we raise revenue. I mean, all of these things were simply allowed to just sit there. And it was either out of fear or complacency or some notion of, like, you know, careerism or whatever it was. But our media largely, and we didn't get a chance to talk about Carol Rosenberg, who is who has been reporting on Guantanamo for maybe a decade. And you can follow her work on Twitter. She works for, I don't know if she's still with Miami Herald. But she is talked about in the book as well. Now she works for the Times. But they're just the failure to hold George Bush to account for these things. And this, that dynamic that the professor talked about in like having this horrible, dirty secret in the closet that, like, everybody knew was there. We just, you know, occasionally had to go by and sort of just make sure the door was still locked. These things, in the aggregate, damage a national psyche, which is not to say that obviously, we don't have a history and didn't have a history of horribleness, whether it's, you know, what we did in Vietnam or, you know, the institutional racism we had in this country, or slavery, or the genocide of the indigenous people in this country. But there was, like, we kicked it up a notch after 2001. where even like, where to the extent that we had made any progress or self-awareness, at the very least, to have shame about certain things, there was multiple years where Rush Limbaugh made millions of dollars off of his show by talking about Club Gitmo. I don't know if this is something that you guys remember, but there were t-shirts. This was an ongoing joke that they had on that show. Like, they're getting better meals down in Club Gitmo than, I mean, this was a marketing campaign for that movement. And I don't know, like, you know, and it was, there was no, there was no pushback of any significance. I don't think that the vast majority of people in this country outside of the conservative movement were like aware of it. And if they did, they just poo-pooed it. But, you know, when you have millions of people who are celebrating the notion of Club Gitmo.
What kind of psycho do you have to be to celebrate that?
I mean, you, it's, there are so many of them. This is what it was in 2004, 2005. I distinctly remember him doing like produced audio packages. Club Gitmo. And it was like an ad for, you know, for Club Med.
Here's some copy. There's no better place than Club Gitmo. Club Gitmo, the Muslim resort. It's a tropical paradise down there where Muslim extremists and terrorist wannabes can get together for rest and relaxation.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, this is, and this was not, you know, a small sort of minority of people. I mean, I was having this conversation over the weekend. Like, this was coming. Everything we see now, pre-Tea Party, here's more of it. Club Gitmo, your tropical retreat from the stress of jihad. Still voting Democrat? You're stuck on stupid. Club Gitmo, staff parking. I mean, this was all. And then it's www.rushlimbaugh.com on these bumper stickers he was selling. This was his audience at this time, was in the probably tens of millions, 15 million people.
Was it 9/11 that just scrambled everyone's brains like that? Or was this something more pre-existing?
It was something that was pre-existing that was then. 9/11 was like an allergen. And I mean, but, you know, Limbaugh had been doing this for 12, 13 years at that point. And had the base and, you know, sort of like the base of people who were convinced that, you know, Hillary Clinton had murdered Vince Foster. And then this is when, I mean, I had this conversation with somebody this weekend, actually, and I forgot about this episode, frankly. He was like, oh, this is from the Tea Party, right? And I'm like, no. This is pre-Tea Party. And there's nothing better than like this as an example. It's all like we didn't know what was going on in Gitmo. It didn't take a lot of, you didn't have to be a super sleuth to know this. I mean, I was talking about it on the radio, but there was just, it was not, you know, to the extent that I would go to dinner parties, people didn't want to hear about it. They didn't know about it. It wasn't something that they were going to argue about. And meanwhile, the other side of that conversation is this: t-shirts, hats, bumper stickers. I think there were senators, if I'm not mistaken now, as I recall it, Republican senators who were getting up in the Senate talking about the three square meals these people are getting down at Guantanamo. And better than they were probably living in Afghanistan.
It's still live up on their website, actually.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, they still have it on the website. They probably still sell this stuff.
They still have people in Guantanamo Bay.
Club Gitmo, still open after all these years at the pleasure of the president. I mean, this is why I say it's the Republican Party, the conservative movement. It is true that that Obama was too weak to close it. But I do think it was true that he wanted to.
Well, something, something, if wishes were horses.
Well, indeed. But there is a like a material difference between celebrating it with T-shirts.
My mola went to Club Gitmo and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. They have a lot of variations.
And, well, and an inability to prioritize it as a political project, particularly when the country was, you know, this is your country. And you're the president and you want to close Gitmo and this is your country.
The detainees are equally detained, whether people are wearing the T-shirts or not.
It's true. It's true. But I guess I'm talking about both, not just from the perspective of the detainees, but of the psyche of the country. And
yeah, this is the point I was making the other day. Like, September 11th changed our culture in profound and terrifying ways for a pretty long time. And some would say that the effects are still lingering to some degree.
I think the effects are still here.
So when a similar kind of attack happens on another country, we have to imagine that it's going to have an effect on their culture as well.
I would think.
I mean, this is the sort of thing why we think these sort of air bombings are like substitute for foreign policies. Like the Brits knew this from the Blitzer in World War II, that air bombing just drives people close together like that.
Yep. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half, do our best. Just a reminder, folks, this program relies on your support. It is your support that makes the show possible. When you become a member, join themajoritypreport.com. Not only do you get the free show commercial free, not only do we give you extra content, we try and do so every day, but you also support interviews like this. You know, there's a lot of times, I can be honest with you, where it's like slightly counter-programmatic. Guantanamo Bay interview. In the heat of impeachment and the 2020 election, but it's important stuff. And I think, you know, for people to have the context of where we are. So your support is always appreciated. Again, if you can't afford it and you want access to the fun half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We got a lot of response last week when I mentioned this. Just a reminder, bear with us. It takes a little while to get there, but usually happens over a weekend or a little bit of long weekend or a break, depending on you know, what we have in terms of, well, child custody arrangements. Essentially, it's a big part of that. Don't forget the AM Quickie. This is a 5 minutes in the morning. Every morning we get it out the door. Right now we're still, I think, around 8:30, but we will pretty soon. It's going to be close to 8, right? Maybe earlier, and it just sets the table for you. Get a sense of what you know. What you should be aware is going to happen today, or just happened last night, or yesterday, or what. It just gives you a little bearing for the day, and a little advance warning of what you're going to be subjected to on that day. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority, get 10% off. Is there a TMBS? Not Tuesday night, right?
No. There will be a premiere interview going live tomorrow night, though, so look forward to that. And then I think we're going to have a show maybe the weekend, or maybe it'll be next Tuesday. We'll see. But he's on a top secret mission right now.
Top secret. Jamie, not on a top secret mission. What's happening with the Antifada?
This week on the Antifada, I speak with Leslie Lee III about Bong Joon-ho's amazing movie, Parasite. Really cool movie with a lot of anti-capitalist themes running through it. Usually I don't care about spoilers, but I will say
No.
For this one, you definitely don't want spoilers.
Okay.
So maybe don't listen.
I haven't seen it yet.
If you haven't seen the movie
yet. Here's a spoiler. Elon Musk said it was his favorite movie of the year.
That is definitely a spoiler.
Well, you know what? He is wrong to like it. I'll just say that much. But that's coming out on Wednesday. So all of you crazy billionaires out there have 2 days to see the movie before you can listen to my episode about it. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt?
Literary Hangover. Alex and I did The Sotweed Factor, a 1708 poem by a guy named Ebenezer Cook, who we don't know much about, we use it as a launching pad to talk about the early Chesapeake tobacco proletariat and how Queen Elizabeth was really racist and the Brits used the enclosing of the commons to provide a labor force that they could use to colonize America. So,
sweet!
A lot of stuff you can get there in Literary Hangover. Patreon.com/literary hangover.
Starting to sound like History Hangover.
Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, and I know what it was. Meanwhile, Ways and Means apparently destroyed it Friday night at...
Means and Ways.
Means and Ways? Oh, yeah. All right, well, I mean, Means and Ways. Means and Ways destroyed it the other night. Do you guys have a new... when's your next show? You got to come back... We got to talk about marketing, buddy. After a big win like that, you got to be able to announce the next show.
Did
apparently
you get any fans
huge.
Out there? Majority Report people?
We had to have place security downstairs. All the groupies. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.